Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS 89.5 and WETS HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Well, this is the second of two episodes devoted to a fellow that you really need to know about. You don't know enough about him yet, but after this episode, you will. His name was Frederick Douglass, and he was among the leading abolitionists in our country during and after the Civil War. Actually, he was if not unique among abolitionists, he was certainly in the first rank because, of course, Frederick Douglass began life as a slave. Now, to tell us all about Frederick Douglass is an actor. His name is Fred Morsell, and Fred has been portraying Frederick Douglass in a number of venues for several decades now, and he is an absolute wealth of information. When we left off last time, we just got an explanation from Fred Morsell about why Frederick Douglass had added that second S to his last name. It turns out it was actually part of his establishing a new identity for himself and his family as free people.
And in 41, in the summer, he attended the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Convention that was held on Nantucket Island. And it was there that he was looked up by a gentleman by the name of William C. Coffin, who was a resident of New Bedford and who Douglass knew. And it turns out that William C. Coffin is a relative also of Lucretia Mott, because that was her maiden name before she married James Mott. And he was solicited by him to speak to the 300 or so delegates there at the convention. And Douglass was terrified because he had only spoken maybe, you know, in small little church meetings with five or six people around there, or maybe a few more. But he got up, and even though he said, "I was shaking all over my knees, shook," and everything, he said, "I'm not sure that my incoherence was not the most effective part of my speech, if speech can be called." He was very self-deprecating about himself at that point. And when he was finished, the audience was just stunned because they had never had a fugitive slave who was as articulate as Douglass was to get up and talk to them about what slavery was really all about. And that's when immediately William Lloyd Garrison jumped up and said, is this a man or a slave? Are we going to let him be taken from the old Dominion and go back to the South? And at that point, he was solicited by Garrison and also John A. Collins, who was the agent of the Massachusetts Society, to become a lecturer for them. And that's what began his whole career. And he spent the next 4 years lecturing for the Massachusetts Society and the American Anti-Slavery Society, which was the larger group that the Massachusetts Society was functioning under. And it was during the last, oh, say, 2 or 3 years of his speaking, in 43, 44, that he began to hear people say, you know, he doesn't look like a slave, doesn't talk like a slave, doesn't act like a slave. I don't think he's ever been south of Mason and Dixon's line. And so to prove that in point of fact he had been a slave, he then wrote the narrative. And that's when he gave the names of Aaron Anthony, Thomas Auld, Lucretia Auld, Sophia Auld, and all the other people he knew, his mother's name, and so on and so forth. And as soon as it was published, before it was actually published by the American Society in Boston, Wendell Phillips, one of the great, great orators of the 19th century, said to him, he said, "If I were you, I'd take this and I'd throw it in the fire."
Really?
Because everybody doesn't know who you are.
Oh, of course, of course.
And we may not be able to protect you. And so the book was published in the spring of 45, and almost within a couple of months after its publication, he was sent by the Society to England to lecture so he could be protected. And then his family, his wife at that time, and they still, at that time, they had four children.
Well, before we get to England, this is extraordinary. So they put him up to speak. He speaks. He speaks so remarkably well that they immediately say, you know, is this a man or a slave? And then they use him for all these speeches. Mm-hmm. And then the very eloquence that got him that attention and got him that position is used,
that caused him to leave the country.
Used against him. So that's he right. Writes his book, his autobiography, in response to prove that someone in Congress, I was a slave.
Yep.
And then now he's given too much information about himself. He's violated his own anonymity.
That's correct.
And now they have to get him out of the country.
You hit the nail right on the head.
Well, that's you told me. I'm just trying to summarize it and make sure I understand this very strange chain of events. And now they have to get him out of the country because he's had to prove that he was a slave.
That is correct. See, the thing is that I'm glad you just said what you said, because, and you're doing what you're doing because I've been living with this for 29 years of my life. And so for me, I understand that sometimes people don't quite follow it. But it's wonderful that you do that, because you got it exactly right.
Well, thank you. Occasionally, exactly. I do that. Very occasionally. You have to ask my wife about that. Very occasionally.
Well, I trust you. I think you're obviously a wonderful professor, because you know how to summarize very quickly.
Tremendous.
The bottom line is that he wound up being in, he traveled first to London, to Ireland, then he went to England and to Scotland. And a number of people don't realize, but he actually did go to Wales briefly, to a little small town called Wrexham. Maybe it's not so small. I haven't been there, so I don't know. Wrexham, Wales. Right across the border from England.
Well, I'm going to make a suggestion, Fred. I'm going to make a suggestion. I think that'd be a fantastic trip if you could get the funding for it.
I've been wanting to do that for the longest time, yes.
Yeah, just go over there and figure out where he was and go.
Well, we have the whole itinerary. Mm-hmm. It's very clear. We know where he went. And what I'd like to do is be able to go and do performances in Dublin, maybe go down to Cork, Ireland, to London, obviously, then to Edinburgh, and then also go to that town of Wrexham in Wales, and do about a 2-week tour over there, reprising one or two of his major speeches, and maybe just probably more than less, doing the full length play, so people can become familiar with his life again, and what he really did, and how successful he was, and the kind of tremendous support that he got from the British.
Right.
It's just really extraordinary, because they're the ones who bought his freedom for him. English Quakers.
Oh, hold on. You're getting ahead of me again now.
I don't want to get too far ahead.
That's all right. Now, slavery had been abolished in England by this time.
Yeah. Slavery was abolished in 1833, actually even earlier than that.
Okay. But, what year was he in Britain again?
He was in Britain from 45 to 47.
45 to 47. So within 10 years, slavery had been abolished in Britain.
Yeah.
And so now the people he's speaking to in Britain, they, as you said...
Many of them are abolitionists. Many
right.
of them are anti-slavery. Wilberforce had died in 1833, but he did meet Thomas Clarkson, who was Wilberforce's very close colleague.
Right.
And he did meet Thomas Clarkson in London or north of London, when William Lloyd Garrison came to England sometime in 1847. And the two of them met him. And when they got to the door, Douglas records this in The Life and Times, his third autobiography. He said, when they got there, Thomas Clarkson said, "Ah, Douglas, I know your story, and I've devoted my entire life to the cause of your people. And if I had it to do all over again, I would repeat it without question."
Wow.
And within about a year after that, Thomas Clarkson died, because he's in his 80s at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But Douglas had an opportunity to meet with Thomas Clarkson.
Wow.
One of the two or three key figures, along with Fox and obviously William Wilberforce, in ending slavery in England and throughout the entire, the British Isles. And, of course, France had Toussaint Louverture had ended slavery in Haiti in 1809.
Right.
Or I think it might have been a little earlier. I'm not quite sure of my date. I think it's 1809. So, in any case, he's in England for 21 months, actually. And when he returns, he's asked by the British if he wants to stay there and bring his family over. And the temptation was very strong to do so. But Frederick Bailey, or Frederick Douglass at this point, knew that while his life would be comfortable, he could not turn his back on his brothers and sisters, the 3.5 to 4 million of them, who were still in bonds. The whole purpose of what he was doing was to free his brothers and sisters, and basically free the American psyche from the consciousness, from the mentality of slavery. And he could not do that in England. He had to come back here. And so these English Quakers, Anna Richardson and her sister-in-law, Ellen Richardson, and a few others, they raised a committee that raised the money to buy his freedom from him.
Wow.
For him. And so he says that Mrs. Anna Richardson, she would not tolerate the idea of my getting on this ship to return to this, my native country. She placed the papers of my manumission in my hands, refusing to let me get on the ship until I had them. Which the implication is, Stuart, that he had to basically carry those papers with him on his person every single minute of every day until slavery in America had ended.
You know, you hit something, hit upon something there. I mean, we talk from time to time about free black people. And in fact, his grandfather was supposedly mm-hmm. free black. But how really free were you when at any moment someone could come up to you and simply take you back into bondage? Or take away the papers that you might have on your person.
Correct. And don't forget what happened with the passage of the second fugitive slave law with the Missouri Compromise in 1850,
mm-hmm.
when every American citizen could be deputized to arrest free slaves.
And
free blacks anywhere. And he said many, many free blacks left the United States and went to Canada. And he refers specifically to Reverend Henry Highland Garnett. He said, we lost many, many wonderful people who had great ability and could have made tremendous contributions, but they were terrified of being captured into slavery.
Well, I mean, that's what would happen. I mean, you'd have this gang of slave catchers coming up
that's
looking
right.
for you, and
right.
even if you showed them your manumission papers, if they decided that they simply hadn't met their quota that week,
mm-hmm.
they would simply get rid of them, and then all of a sudden you're enslaved again, and you can protest all day long if you want to, but you're still going to be enslaved again.
Judges received $10 if they were able to consign a black person back to slavery, and $5 if they were unable to do so.
Hmm.
That was the second fugitive slave law passed in 1850. The other thing that he had discovered while he was in England was that he would never be able to reach everybody whom he needed to reach with the message of ending slavery. And the best way he could do that, and I think that he was probably encouraged in this, by Anna Richardson and several others of his English friends, and which was to publish a newspaper. So they also loaned him or gave him the money so he could buy a press and printing materials, as he said.
Mm-hmm.
So when he returned to the United States to Lynn, Massachusetts, where his family was living at the time, which is a suburb basically of Boston, and he said to Garrison, I want to publish a newspaper. And Garrison and the abolitionists were very upset about that. They did not want that to happen, because they felt that he was basically like a wood sawyer trying to teach people by writing. He didn't know how to write. He had no training in writing. They said his basic skill was in speaking. And this is one of the subtle aspects of the whole abolitionist movement and the latent racism within the consciousness of those whites who were part of that movement. They wanted Douglass where they could keep him under control and he would do what they needed him to do.
So even in the abolitionist community, they'd been infected by this institution.
Yeah. Yeah, the system of slavery is really a mental thing. It's not a, it manifests physically, but it starts in the mind, and then it moves into the emotions, and then it becomes very complicated and very, very much in need of protection, which means very much in need of keeping people ignorant of what it really is all about.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that about it, because, you know, obviously African Americans were the greatest victims of slavery. They were the primary victims of slavery. But
well, except for the Israelis, you know, in pre-biblical times and all that kind of thing. Yeah.
But I mean, in the United States, I mean, obviously they were the victims. But on the other hand, it was such an evil institution that it infected everything.
Well, Douglass said that, you know, both the slave and the slaveholder
right.
are the victims of slavery.
Yeah,
and that's exactly the key,
mm-hmm.
Because it destroys that sense of that mental freedom that allows the mind to grow and for a person to be able to entertain various different kinds of opinions and insights and understandings so that he or she can gain a greater, wider, broader mental understanding of the world and how he or she fits into the world. I mean, it's all about not confining, but opening and releasing and letting the light. That's what enlightenment means.
Mm-hmm.
Open up the mind so that you can see more. The idea is not to be confined in a space, because the space can be both a physical space, but the real problem with slavery is that it was a mental and emotional confining of the spiritual, of the soul. And that's why it is so wrong, because it does not allow the soul to become all that the soul is capable of becoming. That, in the broadest context, that's what really slavery is trying to do. and why it has to, why it's such an insidious, awful system that must be eradicated, because it prevents a human being from becoming a human being.
Well said, sir. Well said. So I'm guessing he went ahead with his newspaper.
He went ahead with the newspaper. He decided that rather than trying to publish a newspaper in Boston, where the Liberator was being published, he would go to Rochester, New York, which he did. Mm-hmm. And that's where he published the first edition of the North Star on December 3rd, 1847. A year and a half after that, his fifth child, his second daughter, was born. Her name was Annie. And Annie, as he himself says, was the light of his life.
Mm-hmm.
In 1850, he did a lot of lecturing. He published the North Star. But within about a year and a half after he published the North Star, started publishing it, he was in such deep financial straits from a business perspective, because he really didn't have a lot of business acumen. He did not really, he had a lot of errors and things in his writing that had to be stopped, caught at the last minute sometimes, and sometimes they were not caught. And he was explaining his predicament in a letter to a woman named Julia Griffiths, he had met in England, in London, and she said, "I will come from England. I will come and help you with the newspaper." And Julia Griffiths was skilled in business. She was skilled in editing. And so she did. And she came and stayed with the Douglases in their home in Rochester for several years. And she helped him get his house out of mortgage. She helped him turn the newspaper into a really fine weekly and then a monthly periodical. And ultimately, she was accused, as was Douglas accused, by the Garrisonians of some kind of illicit relationship that had no basis in truth. And that really caused the final rift between Douglas and Garrison. But at the same time, Douglas was also, in 1842, shortly after he began lecturing, he had met Elizabeth Cady Stanton through Lucretia Mott.
Mm-hmm.
And Stanton taught him, as he says, the gospel of women's rights, basically telling him there is no right that man can give to women, because all rights come from God. The only thing that man can do, this is Stanton's logic, is to recognize that we as women have the same rights that he does. Stanton was one of the most extraordinary minds this country has ever produced. And I frequently said to kids, and to adults mostly, I said this to adults, if the day ever comes that the American people want to have another statue on Mount Rushmore, it ought to be Stanton. It should be. Because she had such a clarity of mind. She's also considered, from what I understand, to be considered a great theoretician of the feminist movement today, because her mind was so clear, so logical, and so completely able to overcome any kind of argument against women. And
Did Douglas have to be converted to the cause? I mean, was he resistant to the idea?
Not a bit. He said, "I became a woman's rights man from the moment I stepped on the soil of the free soil of Massachusetts." And, you know, when you look at his life, Stuart, I did a timeline on this a number of years ago. You look at his life, you find that almost at every point where something happened in his life, either his mother came to visit him, his grandmother showed him how he needed to gain control over his sense of his core anger against things when things didn't go the way he wanted them. Sophia All teaching him the alphabet and a few words. Anna Murray Douglas selling personal items to give him the money so he could escape from slavery. Everywhere you look in his life, there was a woman who was at the core at that moment where things changed for him in a positive way.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with actor Fred Moorsell, who has portrayed abolitionist Frederick Douglass for several decades. Fred was just telling me that Frederick Douglass was not merely an abolitionist, he was also an exponent of women's rights. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll speak some more with Fred Moorsell. Stick around. Once again, it is constitutional quiz time, and here, returned at last from maternity leave, is our quiz lady, Kelly Carmichael. How are you, Kelly?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing extremely well. Before we go any further, how is the lovely little Madeline?
She is wonderful and cute as always.
Cute as always. How old is she getting to be now?
4 months.
Good heavens. Good. Time flies. And I can attest, folks, I can attest, she is a lovely, lovely little girl. But of course, we're not here just to play parent games. We are here to play constitutional games. And so do you have a tough, tough question for our contestant today?
Always a challenge.
Always a challenge. And let me see if we have a contestant. Do we have a contestant on the line?
We do.
We do. And what is your name, sir?
Leon Marshall.
And where are you from, Leon?
Kingsport, Tennessee.
Kingsport, Tennessee. My favorite Kingsport in all of Tennessee. Not very far from where we are in Johnson City. So thank you for stepping up to the challenge today. What's our question for Leon today, Kelly?
Sure, I have a question for you regarding due process.
Due process, all right.
All right, here we go. The right to due process of law means that government cannot, A, arrest you, B, make laws that you disagree with, C, send you to prison, or D, treat you unfairly.
Oh, those are four things nobody wants to happen to him. But can we hear the choices again one more time?
Sure. The right to due process of law means that government cannot A, arrest you, B, make laws that you disagree with, C, send you to prison, or D, treat you unfairly.
Well, Leon, what do you think of those answer choices?
I'm going to have to go with D, treat you unfairly.
Well, that's interesting. Why do you center on that one so quickly?
Well, generally due process would involve, it would encompass all of the things that were previously listed in A, B, or C. You have a due process right before being arrested or convicted or sent to prison. You don't necessarily have a right to prevent the government from making a law that you disagree with, because obviously several people disagree with many laws that we have.
Well, so there's some laws out there you disagree with, huh, Leon?
What now?
Are there some laws out there that you disagree with?
I think there's some laws that everyone disagrees with.
Okay. Okay, and so in C and A, what about A? What about A? Is the government, I guess the government can arrest you, can't it?
They absolutely can arrest you. Yeah. Obviously, they have to afford you due process, but...
And I guess C, they can also send you to prison. So
yes, but once again, you'd have to afford the person whatever their due process rights are.
Okay, so due process is something that you get along the way to those other three things in A, B, and C. That sounds like a pretty good analysis to me. What do you think, Kelly?
I think you're correct. D is correct. Treat you unfairly.
Well, Leon Marshall, congratulations. You got it right off the bat, and you got it for the right reasons. And in fact, I might just phrase it slightly differently and say that A, B, and C are all things that we all know happen every day, right?
They do.
Yeah, I mean, people get arrested every day. Every day somebody, as you pointed out, some legislature somewhere passes a law that somebody disagrees with, and people get sent to prison every day. So the only one of those choices that even comes close would be to be treated unfairly. And that, generally speaking, is what most people will say is the common sense, everyday, plain English definition of what due process of law means. It simply means that there's a general requirement that government treats us fairly. I don't know about you, Kelly. I think that's a pretty good idea.
I think it is very important that we do that.
Okay, Leon. Well, you get a T-shirt, so congratulations, and thank you for playing in our constitutional quiz.
Thank you.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with actor Fred Moorsell, who's portrayed Frederick Douglass for decades now. Now, one of Fred's concerns about Frederick Douglass is that we don't teach our children enough about him in the schools. But, you know, there was a time when Frederick Douglass was featured very prominently in our history classes. In fact, he was so prominent that occasionally Frederick Douglass made his way into popular culture.
Haven't you forgotten something?
Say, who were... Hey, aren't you Frederick Douglass? Yeah, we studied about you in school yesterday, about how you were a slave and how you took your own freedom, and then began to fight for freedom and dignity for all our people. Say, but what did I forget?
Are you going to go out into the world with your hair looking like that?
Well, Mr. Douglas, you know, times have changed. We wear the natural now.
You call that a natural? That's a mess. I've been watching the progress of our people, and I'm quite familiar with the natural. And I'm also aware that it is worn as an outward expression of pride and dignity. So haven't you forgotten?
Right. My Afro Sheen comb easy and hairspray for Sheen. You know, I can dig this getting my fro together.
My sentiments, almost exactly.
Well, how's this, Mr. Douglas? Mr. Douglas? Man, ain't nobody gonna believe this.
Well, that was a blast from the past. Rest in peace, Don Cornelius. And now let's continue my discussion with actor Fred Moorsell, who's telling us about Frederick Douglass, not just an abolitionist, but an exponent of women's rights.
And so he literally has been a women's rights man from the beginning. And that's the title of one of several of his speeches, which is why I call the speech that I give now, where I've compiled a variety of his different speeches on women's rights. I say, why I became a women's rights man. He was very proud of that. Way ahead of his time. Stanton said that of all the women she knew, all the men that she had ever met in her life, including her own husband, Henry Stanton, who was an abolitionist, of all the men, she said, I have never met any man who understood the circumstances of women better than Frederick Douglass. And they were friends to his death.
Well, that is a remarkable overlap. We've done some episodes on the women's suffrage movement and women's rights generally, and I was aware of that overlap, but I was hearing it from the women's suffrage perspective. I hadn't heard it from Douglass's perspective. All right, so what happened after that then?
In 1848, he has an opportunity to meet John Brown. He is impressed with Brown's desire to create cadres in the mountains above, in Virginia specifically, above the plantations and run scores of slaves off at night and create a reign of terror.
Right.
And that's what Douglass thought Brown was going to do. In 1852, Douglass is invited by the Ladies Anti-Slavery Society of Rochester to deliver a 4th of July speech. He says, I will not give a speech honoring America's 4th of July, freedom, independence, liberty, on the 4th of July, considering the fact that 3 million of your citizens are not allowed to even be considered human beings in this country, not to mention the fact that 50% of the population, namely women, are not allowed the right to vote. However, he said, I will give a speech on July 5th, and that's why it's called the July 5th speech, the 5th of July speech. But he gave that, and it's a speech in which he challenges America to take a stand for her principles, which is, of course, something that the American people have been faced with basically on a daily basis from the beginning of our union in 1787, with the Constitution approval. And so it's something that, I really believe that it is something that we as a people of America, black, white, or indifferent, male or female, doesn't really matter, all of us have on a daily basis to be conscious of the difficulty of truly practicing freedom and liberty and opportunity and hope and ensuring that everyone has access to those. That's what the Constitution guarantees, and that's what's so critically important, that we have got to remember that every day freedom must be defended. Doesn't mean you have to get a gun or anything. That's not what I'm talking about. But you have to defend the principles upon which this nation exists and is able to thrive. That's another aspect of what he's really trying to say in that 5th of July speech. And then, in 1854, 2 years later, Congress passes the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which basically opens up slavery across the Pacific Ocean. And then in 57, Roger Brooke Tawney reads the decision of the Supreme Court saying that blacks have no rights that the white man is bound to respect.
Dred Scott. Yeah.
And then in 59, in August, Douglass is called from Rochester to meet in a rock quarry in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, John Brown. And he's told to bring Shields Green with him. Shields Green is this escaped slave from South Carolina who has been staying with Douglass in his home in Rochester. And they meet down there, and that is when John Brown says, I'm attacking Harper's Ferry. And Douglass says, are you out of your mind? Are you out of your mind? That's attacking the federal government. We will turn the entire populace of the American people against the whole abolitionist cause. But Brown says, no, something must be done. And on the night of 16 October, 1859, they're assembled in the mountains of Maryland near the confluence of the Potomac and Shenandoah Rivers, a squad of 19 men, 14 of whom were white, 5 of whom were colored. They were thoroughly armed and equipped for war. And that is how Douglas begins his speech honoring John Brown in 1881, many years later. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is Brown attacks Harper's Ferry. He is captured after 30 hours by Colonel Robert E. Lee. Shields Green is in the mountains, having run away and escaped. And when he's asked by another member of the party, do you want to go with me and escape, or do you want to go back and be with Captain Brown? And Shields Green says the immortal words, I reckon I'll go down with the old man. Mm. And go down with the old man, Shields Green did. And every time I read what Douglas says about Shields Green, who is this ignorant young slave man from South Carolina, I always get very choked up about it, because Douglas recognized that Shields Green, with his ignorance, but with his pure heart, his simplicity, was willing to give up what Douglas always felt guilty he did not give up, which was his life. But it would have been a tremendous waste if he had done that. Consequently, he had to say to John Brown, I cannot do this with you.
Well, he also thought it was a bad plan.
Pardon me?
I mean, it's one thing to give up one's life, but if you think that it's a bad plan, as
well,
Douglas did.
And if you know it's a bad plan, yeah.
But
that doesn't prevent the emotions from saying, I wish I could have done both. And obviously he could not do both. And so, unfortunately, the night that Brown is captured, the attack is at midnight of the 16th. On the 17th is when Brown is captured by Lee. And Douglas is in Philadelphia giving a speech. And the word comes over the wire that in John Brown's carpet bag, Frederick Douglass's name was found. Because one of the things that he had brought from Rochester when he went to meet with Brown in August was money and letters and things from a variety of different supporters of the John Brown effort.
Mm-hmm.
And so Douglas was walked by a friend of his by the name of Franklin to the docks in Philadelphia, where he takes a ferry boat up to New York City, and he takes a ferry boat across to Hoboken, New Jersey, and it's there that he makes contact at Mrs. Marks's boarding house with a German woman by the name of Ottilia Ossing, whom he had met in the early, in 1854, 1855. And there was a certain kind of romantic implication going on there that was nowhere near as serious on his part as it was on hers. But in any case, she arranged with a number of other members of the German community in Hoboken to get Frederick Douglass from Hoboken to Paterson, New Jersey, where he's able to take the train, the Erie Lackawanna Railroad, which goes from Paterson to Elmira, New York, and that's where it ends at this point in 1859. And it's there in 1859, around the 18th or 19th of October 1859, that he meets Charles Langdon. And Charles Langdon is the son of Jervis and Olivia Langdon, who live in a small town called Millport, north of Elmira. And they are abolitionists. And they get him from Elmira through Millport to the Finger Lakes, where he takes the ferry boat across Lake Seneca, gets to Rochester, and he's only home for about 2 hours before he's notified by neighbors that a warrant has been issued for his arrest. And so Annie, at this point, who's like almost 10 years old, the last thing she sees is her father getting on a horse late at night, riding due west to Niagara Falls from Rochester. And she never knows if she's going to see him again. And the thing is that Douglas gets there. There are a lot of small towns that are now basically collectively called Niagara Falls, Ontario, Niagara Falls, New York.
Right.
And he goes around the falls, and he stays in a small town, I'm trying to remember the name of it, St. Catharines, that's what it is, St. Catharines. And that is a place where Harriet Tubman has lived for about the last 7 or 8 years in that small town. And that was the main place that slaves, when they left the United States, went in Canada before they were disseminated themselves out to other parts of the country. St. Catharines in Ontario.
Right.
And Douglas is there for 3 weeks, making contact by letter and so on and so forth with his wife, with Anna in Rochester, receiving clothes and such like that. And on the 12th of November, he leaves St. Catharines and goes either across Lake Ontario or by train around it to Quebec. And that's where he takes the Scotia for England. And he arrives in England sometime in December, and he's basically lecturing there because he had to get out of the country a second time now.
Right, because they're chasing him because they think he was involved in the Browns and the Harper's Ferry raid. Yeah.
Right. And so he's there, and in March, about 4 months or 5 months after he arrives there, he receives a letter that Annie had died.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And so he immediately returns through Nova Scotia back to Rochester. And by that time, it's now into April of 1860, and the whole effort on John Brown has long since passed. Brown has been executed on December 2nd of 59, as was Shields Green, and the talk now is about secession. And Douglas comes back home, and everything is basically forgotten about. Now, the interesting thing about the Langdon family in Elmira and then Millport is that in 1869 or 70 thereabouts, Jervis and Olivia Langdon had a daughter who was named after the mother, Olivia. So they had a daughter and a son, Charlie. And they took a trip to Europe. And on that trip was a gentleman by the name of Mark Twain. And they became friends. And one thing led to another, and I'm not 100% clear on all the dates, but my understanding is, I think I saw this, I was watching this on PBS, everything on Mark Twain's life. The bottom line is that they invited Twain to their home for Thanksgiving dinner, I believe, either in 70 or 71, somewhere around there. And when the door opened, he got there, it was the daughter Olivia Langdon. And Mark Twain was totally smitten by her. And when dinner was over, apparently he asked her as he was leaving if she would marry him.
That was abrupt.
And she says, of course not. So he said, ask her if he could write her a letter. She said, yes, you may write to me. And apparently over the next, like, 15 or 17 months, he writes her, like, every day. And finally, the family and asks them for permission if he can marry their daughter. And apparently, the family was able to make contact with some of the people whom Twain had known in Nevada and San Francisco and other places. And to a letter they received, they were told, whatever you do, keep your daughter as far away from Mark Twain as you possibly can. He's a liar, he's a drinker, he cusses a blue streak, and one thing led to another. Unfortunately for him and for Olivia Langdon, or Olivia as he called her, they did not listen to what his friends said. And so that became the love of his life. And
wow.
In 1884, Mark Twain, I believe, through the influence of Olivia, his wife, and the Langdon family as being abolitionists, he came to understand much more about slavery than he had beforehand, because his father in Missouri was a slave owner. And I believe that as a result of that, as well as his own innate integrity, he wrote what I consider to be the definitive book, anti-slavery book, called Huckleberry Finn.
Right, Huck Finn.
It's the greatest book. I like Uncle Tom's Cabin, that's great, but it's Huckleberry Finn that is the real anti-slavery book, because it's a book that extols the virtues of the human spirit,
mm-hmm.
much more so than anything that's really locked in to a skin racial kind of thing. And the reality is, I've heard a couple of professors talk about this, and I've read it myself, and it's the conclusion I came to. You look at that book of Huckleberry Finn, all 400 pages of it, and if you write down every single character, you just go through the page from page one to the end, you write down every single character, you will discover that with all the characters in there, there is only one character who personified everything that is considered good about an American citizen. Loyalty, love, honesty, integrity, joy. And he's the one person that everybody else hates or has something to hate about him. And that character is Jim.
Right.
And I always ask students, so do you think that Mark Twain, when he wrote that book, that he was drunk and he didn't know what he was doing? Or did he do that intentionally? to bring home the hypocrisy of America and to show you how simple and easy it is to truly love another human being. And that's what Huck Finn goes through, because Huck is the American man and woman. It's an astonishing story.
It is astonishing, and it's a wonderful book.
And I think it's the greatest thing in the world. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. And yet, I hear all the time, I'm sure you probably heard this too, Stuart, you know, there are black families, and they always identify themselves as black, saying, we don't like it because he uses the N-word.
Yep. It's so sad.
And it's insane. It's nuts.
Sad.
And I will fight anybody, anywhere, at any time about that, because I feel
okay.
so strongly about it.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with actor Fred Morsell about the primary subject of his acting, Frederick Douglass. Fred was just telling me about a relationship between Douglass and Mark Twain. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll speak some more with Fred Morsell. Stay tuned.
African American, don't know my date of birth. Right away a slave since the day I met with Earth. Under my first master, Mr. Captain Anthony, I was ripped and washed in pleasure in his acts of cruelty. All took over property, and that includes me too. They treated me no better, man. What was I to do? Well, I started to educate myself.
To read!
My ultimate goal, man, is to
be freed!
Yeah, my master's voice will be a shame.
Thomas Jefferson, in a rare disagreement with James Madison, let it be known that he believed the absence of a Bill of Rights was a dangerous omission in the new Constitution. Jefferson wrote that he was thoroughly unconvinced by the arguments from James Wilson that a Bill of Rights was unnecessary in a government whose powers were already limited through enumeration. The doctrine of limited powers, he said, was opposed by strong inferences from the body of the instrument. Moreover, the Article of Confederation had declared in express terms that each state would retain every power not expressly delegated to Congress. The new Constitution did not. Jefferson concluded that a Bill of Rights is what the people are entitled to against every government on earth, general or particular, and what no just government should refuse or rest on inferences. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with an actor today, but not just any actor. I'm speaking with Fred Morsell, and Fred has spent the last 30 years portraying primarily one fellow, Frederick Douglass. In fact, Fred is so knowledgeable that he's frequently been invited to speak to various civic organizations and groups, and let's just play a little excerpt now from his visit to one particular place, the Orr Elementary School.
Mr. Morsell is an actor. Some of you may have seen him in some of his productions. He has a great interest in Frederick Douglass. Let's give Mr. Morsell a warm welcome to Orr School.
Good afternoon. That sounds great. Now, how many of you, I shouldn't ask you this, but I'm going to ask you anyhow. How many of you have heard of Frederick Douglass? Raise your hands. Terrific. Okay, well, what I want to do today is I want to tell you a little bit about where Frederick Douglass was born. And most of you, I think, know that he was born here, right? Do you know that? Okay, well, I asked Ms. Bradshaw if she would put together a map. How many of you can see this? You may not be able to see it exactly in terms of the names. Okay. But we are here in Washington, D.C., and I assume we're in the southeastern portion of Washington. Is that correct? Okay. So that means we're down around this area here. But he was born in Talbot County on the eastern shore of Maryland, in and around the Tuckahoe Creek and the Choptank River. All which flow around in this area here, Tuckahoe, Hillsboro, Easton, St. Michael's. Have any of you ever been down in that area? Yeah? Any of you from that area? Born down there? Lived down there? Okay. But he lived here for the first 8 years of his life. And for the first, actually almost the first 6 years of his life, as some of you may know in reading his autobiography, the narrative, or if your teachers ever read it to you, this is the first book. The first autobiography that he wrote in 1845. So he wrote this book about 150 years ago.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And in just a moment here, I'll continue, in fact, conclude my discussion with actor Fred Morsell about Frederick Douglass. But in the meantime, let's return to my student, Ryan James, who is, in fact, the fellow who brought Fred Morsell to my attention, because Ryan wants to tell us a little bit more about a very interesting meeting that Douglass had with, not with Lincoln this time, but with someone else.
Right. You enter into the picture. In fact, if I could backtrack momentarily, in 1864, Douglass and Lincoln met for a second time.
Oh, okay. So there was a second meeting between Lincoln and Douglass.
Yes.
Okay.
And at this juncture, it had become more apparent, at least what I've discovered in my research, that either Douglass was rubbing off on Lincoln, or Lincoln found another incentive or discovered another incentive to actually fulfill some of Douglass's vision in affording some equality to blacks outside just the scope of freedom, but economically and socially, and, and allowing them to fully integrate as people under the Constitution. In fact, Lincoln wrote a letter to the Democratic editor of the Green Bay Advocate, where he made the case for what was called the relationship among emancipation, black soldiers, and Union victory. And he was quoted as saying, "Why should they give their lives for us with full notice of our purpose to betray them?" Which in and of itself is a pretty powerful statement. I think it was becoming more and more apparent that Lincoln was starting to side with Douglass in regards to equality overall for African-Americans.
You know, that's remarkably forward-looking, Ryan. And in fact, it reminds me of what happened many years later at the end of World War II, which many people mark as the beginning of the modern civil rights era. That was one of the strongest arguments that civil rights advocates had, is that you've had all these African-American soldiers, and they've laid down their lives for us. Many of them have lost their lives. Isn't it time to give them full equality? And Lincoln was making that same argument during the Civil War.
Right. And one of the steps that he took, and again, this is, it's very hard to find documentation on this, but I managed to do so. One of the steps he took was to appoint a general by the name of William Tecumseh Sherman, who, in my personal belief, is one of the great unknown heroes of the Civil War era. General Sherman.
Well, he's known, but he's not so celebrated, at least in certain parts of the country. All right, but
correct,
anyway.
Correct.
Okay, tell us about this guy.
He was a general. I believe he was out of Ohio, if I'm not mistaken. But he had some tremendous victories, in particular Georgia, Florida, and the Carolinas. He stood next to Grant at Appomattox when they defeated, well, forced the surrender of the Confederate armies there. And with Lincoln's consent. Now, of course, you had Douglass meet with Lincoln and express his desires. And then Lincoln, as kind of a consolation to all this, either spoke with him directly or sent message to him through a guy by the name of General Stanton, who was out of Massachusetts. He sent Stanton down to meet with Sherman in Savannah, and they met with about 20 black leaders who were primarily Baptist and Methodist ministers from the churches down there. The topic of conversation was sort of a policy, if you will, an issue called Special Order 15. Field Order 15 is more commonly known as 40 acres and a mule. What that entailed was blacks who had either escaped slavery, fought alongside of Sherman in this war, or were refugees of some sort, were to be afforded acreage of land. Now, this land had been either confiscated from Southern slave owners or had essentially been bombarded through the trials and tribulations of war and were left rather abandoned. And the, again, from Sherman's aspect, again, Sherman was not known as a anti-slavery kind of guy. His sentiment was, "I'm for the Union. Whatever perfects the Union, that's what I represent." And he agreed to some extent that in order to perfect this Union, we need to take a lot of these former slaves, now soldiers and others, and afford them the same opportunities that everyone else has. The objective of 40 acres and a mule was to allot certain acreages of land to these former slaves and refugees, and also loan them mules. And that would have allowed African Americans to really crop their own land, cultivate, build on it, and do pretty much whatever they
What happened to that 40 acres and a mule? We've all heard that phrase. Did it actually come to fruition?
Unfortunately, it was there was no tangible benefit gained from it. There was some wealth and prosperity, however short-lived, by a few African-American families. In fact, I believe about 40,000 African-American former slaves found their way to this land and actually, you know, took in some benefit from it, but it was nothing for the African-American community to hold on to. President Lincoln was assassinated, mm-hmm. and a fellow by the name of Andrew Johnson, mm-hmm. one of I believe, two presidents who were impeached or attempted to be impeached, he was sworn in shortly after Lincoln's assassination, and he rescinded the order. He revoked 40 acres and a mule, and he ordered, again, he was sympathetic to the South, and by him ordering the revocation of that issue, the land had to be returned to white owners.
I understand Douglas actually met with Johnson once and said something along the lines, I'm paraphrasing, that man is no friend of ours.
No friend of ours, right. He was such a, he's so sympathetic to the South at that point. And his impeachment or attempted impeachment kind of spoke to that.
That was actually a conflict between him and the radical Republicans up in the North. Yeah, part right. and parcel of all of that. Mm.
And I think long term for the African-American community and being a young African-American, I think there's a direct correlation between what could have been had 40 acres and a mule been allowed to stand. I mean, you would have had great deals of wealth built up and transferred from generation to generation. And this shouldn't strike you at all. The highest concentration of wealth amongst African Americans, at least statistically, is in Atlanta, Georgia. Mm-hmm. That was one of the places where 40 acres and a mule took off from. So someone profited there during that era. It's just, it was few and far between.
Well, thank you very much, Ryan James, for giving us that fascinating insight into Douglas's meeting with Lincoln and then subsequently Sherman's actions down in the South and Douglas's meeting with... Douglas was everywhere.
Yeah,
Douglas
he was.
Seemed to talk to everybody and have an effect on everyone, so thank you for those insights.
Absolutely. I appreciate it.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Now let's finish our discussion with actor Fred Morsell.
And Douglas, this is one of the great things about him. He was an extremely pragmatic individual, along with being a great idealist. His idealism was manifested when he married across the color line. But from his perspective, that was not idealism. That was just simply being practical. He was in love and he wanted to get married to the woman he loved. The fact that she happened to be a woman in a pale skin had nothing to do with it. So the whole thing is that what we come to the conclusion is that Douglas's life really reflects trying to live at the height of what America, what a human being can be, that the height of the human spirit, not at the lowest degraded level. And that's really what being a citizen of this nation is about. And these are things that I've learned only from having read endless numbers of his articles, speeches, and what other people have said about it. And so he finishes this speech in 1893. The convention, the World's Fair closes in October, the end of October of 1893, and Douglas continues to give speeches, continues to talk, writing letters, and so on and so forth. And on February 20th, 1895, in the morning, Helen is going to the Library of Congress to do some research, and Douglas goes to Metzrat Hall in Washington, D.C., to attend the business meeting of the National Woman's Suffrage Association meeting that's being chaired, apparently, or being one of the leaders, is Susan B. Anthony. And when Douglas walks into the building, all the ladies get up on chairs and start waving their white handkerchiefs, which was their sign of recognition and honoring a person. Mm-hmm. That's how they did it. And he spends virtually the entire day there. And then late in the afternoon, he comes back to the house in Anacostia, where they live, Cedar Hill, and they have dinner. And he's busy showing and demonstrating, because he was also kind of an actor, too, Stuart.
Uh-huh.
And he's demonstrating to Helen how, you know, how the meeting went and how certain ladies functioned and how they acted and what they said. And it's really kind of entertaining. And about 5:45 or close to 6 o'clock, they know the carriage is coming very shortly to pick them up and take them to a little church where he's going to give a speech or a comment or remark that evening. And he walks into the vestibule out of the west parlor. And as he walks, reaches for his coat and for Helen's coat, he suddenly relaxes, his hand relaxes, and he grabs at his chest and he collapses to the ground. Helen immediately sees what's happening. She runs out the door, down these long steps across the street to a neighbor who happens to be a doctor. And he comes running across the street with her, back up the steps, and they get there. And 20 minutes later, Frederick Douglass is dead. And 5 days later, they have his funeral at Metropolitan AME Church in Washington, D.C., and then the train takes the remains to Rochester, where there's another ceremony, and he's buried in Mount Hope Cemetery. Anna Murray is buried on one side of him. Their daughter Annie is buried next to them, and then there's another grave right next to that for Helen Pitts Douglas. And that is his life.
77 years old?
77 years old.
Wow. A long and remarkable, remarkable life.
Yeah, it really is quite a remarkable story.
Well, Fred, I appreciate your sharing that story with us, and the only thing I can say at the end of it is that maybe it was a good thing that work was so scarce back in 1984. Because you never would have embarked upon this great journey, and you never would have learned all these remarkable things about this remarkable man, and you never would have shared them all with us, and I have just enjoyed this so much. I really have, and I've learned so much as well.
Well, I appreciate that. I think that you're right on the money. I think now that the first 16 years I spent working professionally in Hollywood and New York and elsewhere was all grist for the mill. It was all training to get me ready to be able to handle this next level of work. And from now on, you know, we've got the, hopefully the book will be able to be published to the right publisher and sometime this spring, because the editing is going very, very well. What I've done was I've taken, if I may just...
Sure.
Apparently, just throw this out. I've taken all three of Frederick Douglass's autobiographies, and I've integrated them into one. And the reason for that was when I first got a hold of all three books, I kept thinking to myself, why are there three? There should only be one. They should be in one contiguous story, and one continuous story. And so I think that we've been successful in doing that. It's still more than 90% his own words, which is really what's important, because I'm not so interested in people hearing what I have to say about Frederick Douglass. I want them to hear what he had to say, because that's what turned me on 29 years ago.
What's the title of your book?
Well, tentatively, it's called Frederick Douglass, From Bondage to Freedom, Narrative of the Life and Times of the 19th Century Slave Who Became an Apostle of Liberty. I suspect my editors are not going to like that very much, but
They might shorten it a little bit.
But, you know, basically the title is Frederick Douglass, From Bondage to Freedom.
Very nice. And do you have a website people can visit?
Yeah, the website is in the process of being redone with taking advantage of some of the new technology that we've got today. But it's right, basically it's www.frederickdouglass.org. And that's FREDERICKDOUGLASS.org.
Well, Fred Morcell, also known as Frederick Douglass in your interpretive time, thank you so much for sharing this fascinating tale with us. We really do appreciate it. And that's our show. Thanks indeed to Fred Morcell, who gave us so much information about Frederick Douglass that we had to set out the interview over two full episodes. Thanks also to Ryan James, my student at the Appalachian School of Law, who expressed an interest in Frederick Douglass and went out and found Fred Morcell for me. And another thank you today. We have a departure. One of our distribution engineers, Larry Mayer, is leaving us. By the time you hear this show, Larry will be happily retired. Happy retirement, Larry. Our other distribution engineer who's sticking around, as far as I know, is Bob Hoffman. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.